court must decide in favor of the petitioner because he prevails equally under the categorical and also under the modified categorical approach. Turning first to the categorical approach.
Let me ask you something.
Yes.
If we reach that, as I understand it, the BIA assumed that there was not a categorical coverage, and it only decided it on, so don't we just make the same assumption?
Well, I would say no. I think the most important reason is this whole case went up prior to all the Supreme Court precedent decisions in DeKalb, Mathis, and...
They assumed it was not categorical, so that's in your favor, so why don't we just assume the same thing?
Well, I think he went through the categorical more conclusively. I'd like to kind of swim and not believe that argument. I think he does also with the modified categorical approach. Just quickly, there's a five-step approach under the categorical. The first is to identify the general definition. Everybody pretty much assumes that fraud is an element of the offense to be a CIMT, crime involving moral turpitude. And as the court just mentioned, the BIA did concede that 1306A3 is not a crime involving moral turpitude. That's the third prong, not a CIMT because there was no intent to defraud.
So I've only been doing this for 25 years. And I do not like lawyers that read. Tell us your arguments and tell us why your client should get believed.
Very basically,
you can read your briefs and you can read the written study.
A lot of the argument on the categorical approach wasn't in the briefs because, again, it was briefed prior to the Supreme Court's
region.
I did
the BIA didn't rely on that basis, did it?
They did not.
The answer to my question is yes, they didn't rely on it.
It's not
over here on a lot of us. Explain why your client's on a
lot of under the modified approach, I think he wins because. I think the most important case is the Maria Acosta case where the court cannot look to the plea colloquy in order to find that. That it was either prong one or two under the modified categorical approach with the intent to defraud.
He could if he said, I'm pleading to count one or count three, but he didn't, or section such and such or section such and such.
Right. They don't cite the specific subsection under which he was convicted. If you look,
isn't there another problem too, which is that he didn't, in order to be convicted under one, he had to have an intent to defraud. And he never said he had an intent to defraud.
Yes, I was going to point that out on page 37 of the Certified Administrative Records. If you look at the plea colloquy, the words intent to defraud or any kind of fraud are never used. The verbs are utilized, used for, or claiming himself out, whatever that means. But there's no fraud or intent to defraud defined in the plea colloquy. And as the court has mentioned in the Maria Acosta case, it can be very problematic to look to the plea colloquy in order to supply that missing information to which prong he was actually convicted of. The BIA does it, I think, impermissibly. It looks at the plea transcript contrary to this court's precedent in Maria Acosta. And I think that is a good reason why, and we pointed it out in our December 2nd 28-J letter brief, why this case should be remanded, because you really can't tell whether it's an A1, an A2, or for that matter, an A3, since it is an overbroad statute under the categorical approach. I think he prevails under the modified categorical approach. He also prevails equally. Lastly, the BIA is already...
What are we remanding for?
You don't have to remand. I think the court could rule on the modified categorical approach that it's, you can't tell that it's a CIMT or not, so he prevails.
Well, what else would we do? I understand we say have to remand in order to see whether he's eligible for relief or whether he's already granted relief. But as to his eligibility, what would the question be that we would remand on?
The only issue would be for relief for the remand. The court could rule that under the modified categorical approach, it's not a CIMT.
And therefore, we're just remanding as to relief.
Yes. Correct. Prior counsel submitted, as the court noted, the plea transcript on the appeal. The BIA looked at that for the factual basis to try to tell which prong he pled under. I think incorrectly assumed that it was prong one or two, and again, contrary to Maria Acosta, supplied the missing information in the plea colloquy, which I think runs contrary to what the court, the Supreme Court, court said in DeKalb and this court said in Rio Costa. Also, as I mentioned, the BIA and the IJ considered all this information prior to the three Supreme Court decisions in Moncrief, DeKalb, and Mathis. The IJ initially said that all three prongs are CIMTs. The BIA reverses him and says, well, the third prong is not. And there's just kind of a mess of the record. I think it would be, obviously, the best thing for the petitioner's point of view would be to find that it's not a CIMT remand for relief or to remand and let the immigration judge in the first instance look to the record evidence and see whether there's any erroring possible or not and make a decision whether there's a CIMT or not and whether or not he's eligible for relief or any other relief he might have become eligible for since the time of the case. That's all I have on argument.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll have
up to
4 minutes for rebuttal.
Thanks.
Good morning, Your Honors. Dan Shea on behalf of the United States government. This is our position that we believe that the government will prevail on both the modified and the categorical. To answer your question earlier, Judge Berzon, we believe the court does have jurisdiction to look at the categorical analysis because though the board did find that it was not a categorical match, we believe that this is a purely legal question and the court can.
Why? I'm sorry?
It's a purely legal question and it's not over the interpretation of an INA statute, so the court can look at it if it wishes, and we do believe that under Navarro Lopes.
My understanding is that our law about categorical approaches and the relationship with the board is that the question of what the statute is, the state statute is not committed to the expertise of the board, but the issue of what the federal statute here is, the crime of moral turpitude. Yes, so how could we decide this initially without sending it to the board?
Because it still involves interpretation of the state criminal statute.
It involves that, but it also involves an interpretation of the federal crime of moral turpitude statute.
Yes, Your Honor.
I am surprised to hear you, as a lawyer for the board, standing up here and just telling us we should decide something that the board hasn't decided.
Right, Your Honor, and it was just consulting with my colleagues that we decided that looking at the statute more carefully, we believe that A1 and A2 clearly are CIMTs because they include the element of the fraud.
But A1 and A2, but what about A3?
There's still the second problem under Navarro-Lopez, Your Honor, where if it involves knowingly making false representations to obtain something of value, that too is categorically CIMT, and we believe that A3 would meet both of those prongs because it involves an assumption of false identity and in order to obtain access to property, which is something of tangible value.
Did you argue categorical inquiry?
We do not, Your Honor.
Why shouldn't we hear that argument?
We believe you can look at that question to know, Your Honor. You don't have to. We think we still went on to modify, but we're just putting that out there as something the court can look at as well.
If the BIA didn't decide it, and you did not address it in your brief, but you want us to decide it on our own?
As an alternative ground for
this new proceeding?
Certainly, Your Honor. Under the modified categorical approach, we believe that the statute 13-2006 is divisible, and we believe that Marcia Acosta doesn't foreclose the look at the plea colloquy
section of the Arizona statute that goes out of plea
to. We believe that the
clear from the record.
It is not clear from the plea agreement itself, Your Honor. But
you can tell, correct?
From the plea agreement.
From the plea call from the colloquy.
We believe he does not state in the colloquy that it's A1, A2, or A3, but we believe that if you look at the colloquy, it's very similar actually to the one in Marcia Acosta, where it doesn't line up exactly with the particular conviction charge. In Marcia Acosta, he was charged under Arizona Revised Statute 13-1203, and what his plea agreement stated was that he had used a metal pipe or bat to strike someone, and the court looked at that particular factual predicate to determine it couldn't have been A2 under that Arizona statute or A3. It must have been under A1. Marcia Acosta was basically the application, the modified categorical approach on two fronts. So it was first to determine whether it's A1, A2, or A3, and then the government wanted to further divide the statute by looking at A1 and looking at the mens rea requirement and saying that those were separate elements or separate offenses, and the court, I believe, really held that those were different means to commit the same offense.
Talk about this case.
So this is very good.
Which portion of the Arizona statute?
We believe it was A1 because the facts here are almost identical.
But you're focusing on the facts. You're not supposed to focus on the facts in light of DeKalb's, right?
Right, Your Honor.
So how do we get to where you're saying? I mean, we've held pretty clearly focus on that we need to focus on the elements instead of the facts. And it seems here like this plea bargaining context, the defendant often has very little incentive to contest facts because I think I see where you're going to try to eliminate, you know, the other possibilities. But it seems like the defendant in these criminal cases have very little incentive to contest facts that are not elements of the charged offense and, you know, may not want to make superfluous sort of factual allegations. So why would maybe an additional reason why the camps came out the way it did? So I'm trying to figure out why your side stands on
so camps. Because we believe that what the camps and Mathis and his progeny hold isn't that you cannot look at any facts whatsoever. You need to look at the facts that are essential for upholding the conviction. And in this case, I'm sorry, go ahead, Your Honor.
Well, the one thing you can, an element of the 1 and 2 is intent to defraud.
Yes.
You can't play and acknowledge that. You didn't say anything about it. He said he used it to get employment, but he didn't say he intended to defraud anybody. His plea is completely consistent, for example, with an employment who was an employer who was in cahoots with him, right? In other words, an employer who said, you know, I all knew that this was a false statement. And he didn't plead otherwise.
Right, but yet there are other elements in A2 and A3 which are not present in this case. He doesn't contest that it's not A2 because he didn't.
Well, I understand that, but he didn't establish the elements of A1 either, or 2.
I disagree under DeMartinez, Your Honor, because the facts are identical to what we said in our 28-J letter. It was a 2014 decision, and it was almost the same exact facts. It was using a Social Security number in order to obtain employment, and they similarly argued there on page 25 that the conviction does not categorically involve moral turpitude because she used a false Social Security number only to obtain employment, not for anything more nefarious. There's no mention of intent to defraud, and yet the court in that case held that that was categorically a CIMT under A1. It's unclear what he was charged with, but it's the same facts as this case, Your Honor. Both, in both cases, they used a false Social Security number, someone else's, in order to obtain employment.
The statute in
this is a sustained statute, Your Honor. It's 13-2006-81. Oh, sorry, are you just reading the statute?
That's, yeah.
Oh, I see.
It's not a statute, isn't it?
Right, it's the same one. It's the same exact statute that used in our case.
Okay, but it was A1, right?
It's unclear whether that was what he was charged
with. It was A1, it was A1.
Right. But it's unclear whether they matched up the facts to A1 or whether it was just A1. But again, we just point out, we're not saying that Martinez is dispositive on the factual basis, but we think it's pretty illustrative because it's the same set of facts.
However, we have the crimes requiring proof of an intent to defraud necessarily. But the problem here is she never admitted to an intent to defraud. And that's a colloquy.
It doesn't use the exact words intent to defraud. Obviously, the Social Security number does not belong to my client. He had no right to use that.
Correct, but that's different. An intent to defraud includes that you are misrepresenting to somebody who relies on it for some and loses something by it, and there's no element of that pledge.
But, Your Honor, I still think that it's implicit in the crime itself. Because
is that your best argument, that you think it's implicit in the crime itself? Because it seems like we have to look to see whether or not the element fits.
Yes, Your Honor. But, again, we point to other other decisions in which it's, the facts aren't exactly.
There's no reason why Arizona has a separate statute for this. In other words, why A1 and A3 are different, right?
Yes.
And what appears to be different about it is that A3 doesn't have an intention to fraud element.
Yes,
in other words, if you go in and you and your employer perfectly well knows you're using a false identity, it's still a crime under A3.
Yes, Your Honor.
But it doesn't have an intention to fraud.
Right. Right. And so, again, Your Honor, the factual plea, the pleading in the plea colloquy has to support the charge itself. And
it doesn't.
Right, but it doesn't support A2 or A3. Clearly,
it doesn't support any of them, so we don't know either.
That's interesting. Your Honor, even if that were the case, we still think that this case needs, if you want supplemental briefing on the inconclusive record issue, we'd be happy to provide that. But this is not a removability ground. This is a ground for relief from removal. And so if Your Honor decides that this is an inconclusive record under Young, we believe that this case would still end up with the petitioner unable to meet his burden of proof under that case.
I'm sorry, I don't understand. Can you explain what you're asking?
So, if the government is trying to remove the petitioner on this ground, if he's a lawful permanent resident or he has a status otherwise, we bear the burden of proof showing that this is categorically a CIMT or otherwise removable offense. But if the record is inconclusive under this court's en banc decision at Young, the burden of proof is on the petitioner because he's removable regardless of this form of relief. And so, he bears the burden of showing his eligibility for relief from removal. Which would also include showing this is not categorically a CIMT.
Okay, your time is up. Thank you very much. Yes, you have some time. You want to use it? You don't need
to. Really, additional other than to just mention that under DeMartinez, the court seems to have analyzed, and I think you've already pointed out, Judge Broussard, that it was an A1 analysis. It's not a 13206 analysis, but the court specifically cited that immigration judge, the board, looked at 13206, A1, and finding that it was a CIMT with the intention to fraud element. It wasn't the entire statute that was